This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
College admission anxiety. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The cheating and bribery scandal that exposed how some wealthy people get their kids into elite colleges has opened a window into the pressure some are feeling.
On the tech front, you may or may not know that Uber can track you at all times. Should it be doing that?
On this St. Patrick's Day weekend, a look at the unusual celebrations for the holiday, including the town with the shortest parade.
And the growing popularity of do-it-yourself clubs where things get fixed for free.
It's kind of a growing movement where people who like to fix things are sharing their skills with people who can't fix things. But kind of the bigger picture is that these people are starting to rebel against the idea that a lot of manufacturers of electronics and digital technologies are making it harder and harder to fix your own stuff.
Wall Street Journal columnist Ann Cadet on DIY Fix-It Clubs. She's here later in the hour. The federal admissions cheating case unveiled this past week highlights the intense pressure some families feel to not only get their child into a good college, but into the best college possible. Not only do certain schools signal status, but they are a hedge, according to some, against a quickly changing economy that is displacing entire sectors. It's a story by Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. Doug, what's up here?
So the question is, why are people so wigged out about getting into college? And there's a few reasons that we are really demographic and economic that are raising the stakes here. The first one, not for these folks who are so rich who were involved in this admission scandal, but for sort of normal people, is that the college costs a fortune now, and kids are going to come out with debt, and so there's a really high risk. So the question is, if you go to school, will you graduate, and then will you go to the right school that will generate enough revenue, a return on investment, that it makes it worthwhile? And the reality is, kids who graduate from high-end prestigious schools tend to earn more money down the line. So that just amps up the pressure for whether or not what school you should go to. And it's part of the reason why this is happening, I think. We looked at some of the pay scale data. If you graduate from Stanford or Princeton, the return on investment is about $1 million 20 years after you start. And it's less than a third of that for, you know, like a regional state school. So there's a huge difference in what you're likely to earn when you get out, just by the numbers. This has not always been the case, right? A generation ago, if you went to college, it was pretty much a ticket to at least a solid middle-class life. But now there are kids who are graduating, and they just don't make enough to support themselves. And so you hear a lot of stories about teachers who have a second job. That's almost a common story now. So this hollowing out of the middle class, the cost of college being so high, these are all increasing the anxiety around the choice of where to go and indeed whether to go.
Boy. I didn't consider, I guess, I thought, well, anxiety's always been the same to a certain degree. Go to college, seemingly do better in life, generally speaking. But the cost, I guess, has really made it an issue. And that doesn't, I guess, to a certain extent, some schools are recognizing that, but it doesn't feel like it's widespread.
You know, the more schools are willing to give merit scholarships or scholarships in general to help kids get in, but the reality is for more than 20 years, the cost of college has increased at 3 times the rate of inflation, and wages haven't even kept up with inflation for a lot of that period of time. So it's just it's much more of a risk. It's much more of a lift for families to get their kids into school. And if it doesn't work out, it can paralyze you. You can be, if you don't graduate and you have big debt, that can really stiff you for decades. So parents are aware of this stuff, they know what the stakes are, and it's no joke.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. It's slightly off subject here, but certainly tied to this. The spike in cost of college, as you mentioned, like 3 times the rate of inflation for years now. Is that at least somewhat tied to the government giving so much loan money seemingly to anybody in any amount?
Yeah, there's a lot of different pieces to why the cost of college has gone up so quickly. So part of it is that the federal, you know, money is free on the, when you start taking, when you're 18 years old and you sign up for a loan, it doesn't feel like you really have any obligation to it, but of course it comes back at you. But you can borrow a lot of money for school, and kids do. So, you know, by making the money available, schools are taking advantage of that and raising their tuition. For public schools, the amount of money that state legislatures have given schools per student has declined pretty significantly over the last 15, 20 years. It's up a little bit now lately, but the broad trend is that it's down. So if the school is putting less money, sorry, if the government is putting less money into the school is going to make up that difference by raising tuition, and that's what's happened. And then finally, schools are competing hard with each other, and they're competing with things like amenities, and they have a lot more administrators to make sure that the kids are doing well. So all these things combine to jack up the costs that the schools are dealing with, and they pass that along to the consumer.
You said that these days elite schools admit more students from outside the U.S. Why is that? Because they'll pay more likely to pay full freight?
So these big universities have attracted folks from around the country, around the world, rather, for a long time. But with the wealth in China in particular, there's just a lot more smart, wealthy kids able to pay, and the schools are taking advantage of that.
Thanks, Doug. Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. They call it the sharing economy for a reason. Uber is one of a growing number of peer-to-peer networks touted as a way to save you money. But Fox News recently said there's a lingering question about what these services mean for user rights and privacy. Tech analyst Rob Enderle is here with analysis. Rob, set this up.
This came out during the Jesse Smollett case, where they were able to go to Uber, get records of his attackers and where they went, and track them through Uber. And a lot of people got kind of upset because really they didn't know that just because Uber now, you know, when you pay Uber, you can go back and you can see exactly where you went, who your driver was, all the rest of that. Somehow, I guess people thought that Uber didn't keep that, even though that they had it. So yes, Uber has detailed records. Most anything these days where you're buying a service and you're doing it electronically through an app, it's capturing that entire transaction. So what you're buying, where you're going, all of that stuff is in a database, and of course that database is accessible through law enforcement, certainly by the company, but through to law enforcement depending on the policies of the firm. And Uber, because they've been pounded quite a bit for a number of things, is being particularly cooperative at the moment because I think they just don't want to have any more aggravating trouble. They've had, as you know, a broad run of it.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, that means that they got it, they captured it. It can be reviewed, and your life, if you're using Uber or one of the social networking, one of the social sharing services, your life is, of course, is recorded. And as I mentioned, social networks, it's the same thing on social networks. Everything you do on that network, of course, is a matter of public scrutiny. This is a tempest in a teapot, because anybody doesn't think they're being tracked is clearly out of the loop.
I would imagine most people have a vague idea that this is going on. Should we be okay with this as consumers?
Well, I don't think you've got a choice. I mean, the thing is you're being billed for something. If you're going to want to know what you're being billed for, and you're probably not going to remember all the trips that you took, and so having that record means they can go back and say, yeah, you really did take this trip. Or if it's somebody else masquerading as you, which of course does happen, then you can determine by the nature of the trip that, hey, that wasn't me. Somebody else has stolen my credit card or whatever, and you need to fix that as well. They'll typically, you'll notice that when a charge shows up as well.
Yeah. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. We're talking about Uber being able to track you. This makes it seem like such a snap to find out where you've been and where, compared to the old days, right, where you had to track down the taxi operator. Maybe you were lucky if you had the cab number, right?
Right. Yeah, before, if you were taking a cab, the trips were recorded, but it tended to go into a log book that somebody physically maintained. You might have four or five different cab companies in your city, all of them being yellow. So locating which cab company, which dispatcher, which cab driver It could be done, but it required an awful lot of effort and a lot of searching to get to that particular record, often requiring you to physically go to each of the cab company offices because they sure as heck weren't going to do it for you. Now it's all electronic, so you submit the request, they do a database search on your name is identified through the credit card transaction on your account or through your Uber account, and very quickly they can determine where you went. But if you were taking cabs, chances are there was a record of it. Though, you know, a lot of times the dispatchers didn't maintain good logs. And in court, you could certainly argue that maybe the log had, because there's so many people touching it, that maybe the log had been entered in error, or perhaps the evidence had been created after the fact. Yeah. With this stuff, much harder because of the digital nature of the transaction. And the fact that it's validated through the credit card companies, it's much harder to disprove what Uber says you did in a legal case.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. It's a familiar setback, right? You thought you interviewed well for a job. It seemed like a perfect fit, but ultimately you were rejected. Maybe you appeared to lack that mysterious something what hiring managers at that company call potential. They may not be able to explain exactly what it looks like or why they think you don't have it. How do you crack that code? Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's not what you've done in the past, it's what you're going to do in the future. That's how more and more employers are evaluating candidates. Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal has written a piece about this and joins us now. Sue, why are companies focusing on a candidate's potential?
They're trying to make better matches so that they can retain talented employees in this very tight labor market. Hiring is costly for employers. They really want people to be satisfied and to have a chance to advance once they hire them. So rather than just looking at recent past performance, they're trying to size up, what could this person do over time? Does this person really match the profile of people who succeeded our company? So it's more complicated, but it's also a better bet if employers can actually do that.
You say complicated. How in the world can an employer evaluate potential?
This is really hard, companies are trying to use more data-based approaches. For example, they're looking at who has succeeded at this company, and then they analyze, you know, what are the behaviors, the attitudes, the attributes of that person, and then they try to interview for those things, asking questions in the interview that are aimed at teasing out whether that quality is there. In some cases, they use assessments, and they really are working much harder at scrutinizing all aspects of the applicant's life before they hire.
Sue, I think your story mentioned that many internal job moves go wrong. Why would that be?
Well, it is because employers have a hard time sizing up people's potential. Honestly, they tend to miss the potential in female candidates, who tend not to blow their own horn as much, and perhaps promote people who are more open, aggressive, competitive. They also rely on immediate managers who may not really be very good at assessing an employee's potential. There are as many reasons almost as there are employers, and employers are really trying to buckle down on this and do better.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. Sue, what's wrong with hiring someone because they seem to fit into your company culture?
Well, this was popular for a while. There's a lot of talk about cultural fit until people realize that unfortunately resulted in hiring people who look like you, talk like you, travel in the same social circles. That is not a good way to create an innovative workforce or a diverse one. Employers really are prizing diversity and trying hard to set aside social appearance, cultural factors, and just look at what is this person's potential.
Another method that people have to look at is winning promotions. 2 promotions in 5 years, your story talked about. That seems like a kind of a random number.
It is. This is one of those old-fashioned rules of thumb that many employers used and are still using for want of a better formula. They try to envision that person, could she move up twice in the next 5 years? And if they think, yeah, she has a lot of horsepower, they'll go ahead and hire. But this doesn't always work out. I mean, sometimes a person is maybe really good at engineering but can't diversify and develop leadership skills or teamwork skills. So it's more complex than that. That formula would ever capture.
Sue, if you are the candidate and you're going in for an interview, How would you prepare yourself in case you're being sized up for potential rather than what you've done?
The most important thing is to be able to give detailed, factual accounts of your past successes and your past failures. And secondly, to frame your failures as a learning opportunity and not as a flop. It's so important to be able to show the employer in words what you're capable of doing. And that takes practice. I mean, it is really the way I try to write, and you really need to prepare to have those facts at your command.
And if we are not looking solely on this cultural fit thing anymore, you should show that you have some diverse interests.
That's right, that you have a diverse range of acquaintances and contacts, that maybe you're involved in community activities, social groups, volunteering, nonprofits, and that you have high aspirations. Take the trouble to get to know that employer so you know what's likely to be a good fit there. Read everything you can get, including boring stuff like the annual report. See if you can scope out what their strategy, what their corporate DNA is, and see whether you're really a good fit. Whatever you do, don't try to make it fit if it doesn't, because you're just probably going to be miserable there.
And Sue, what if you already work at the company and know a lot about the internal workings of that company? How do you sell your potential there?
It's important to show your ability to work with other teams across departmental boundaries, volunteer for high-pressure projects that you know are important, take part in meetings, take every opportunity to network internally and meet people, not only higher up in the company, but in other departments. That'll demonstrate to your higher-ups that you are both interested in doing more and that you're capable of working on more broad tasks. It'll really help your promotion potential.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. FMLA, FLSA, ACA, EEOC. It's harder than ever for businesses to keep up with today's evolving alphabet soup of regulations. What's a company to do? Kronos. With Kronos, you can minimize compliance risk and track HR policies, making sure they're applied consistently and fairly. HR, payroll, talent and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/compliance. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for spending part of your St. Patrick's Day weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, building a sensible, low-cost portfolio. Also, DIY repair clubs that fix things for free. An unusual St. Patrick's Day traditions, including the one with the shortest parade. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. After decades of earnest public information campaigns, Americans are finally recycling. Airports, malls, schools, and office buildings across the country have bins for plastic bottles and aluminum cans and newspapers. In some cities, you can be fined if inspectors discover that you have not recycled appropriately. But how much of that carefully sorted recycling is ending up in the trash? And in some cases, just being incinerated because it's cheaper? Turns out, a good bunch of it. Alana Samuels at The Atlantic has been looking into it. She's based in San Francisco. Alana, what's changed?
So China used to take our recycling for decades, and last year it stopped taking most of them. And so all these cities and towns that have finally convinced people to recycle, to sort their recycling, you know, put their bottles and cans and paper in a blue bin and their trash in a black bin, are finding that there's nowhere to send it, and it costs a lot to send it, you know, somewhere else to get it recycled. And so it's actually cheaper to just put it in a landfill or burn it. So they're just lumping it in with the trash and throwing it away.
My goodness. I know it was a town, I think, in New Hampshire, you said. They just started burning these plastics, knowing that that's not great for the environment, but they felt they had no other choice.
Yeah, it's a town that had a fair share of low-income people, and the costs were pretty black and white. It was $125 a ton to recycle and $68 a ton to incinerate. So about half the cost to just burn it. So, they didn't love the idea of burning it, but they didn't feel like they had much of a choice.
What's the biggest issue for us? Is it plastic, glass, paper, aluminum, all the
above?
It
really depends on where you are. Plastic, I would say, is a big one. In San Francisco, where I live, glass is actually, there's a pretty good market for glass, and so they can make it back into glass bottles pretty quickly. In a lot of other places, glass is very heavy, so it's really hard to recycle it. Akron, Ohio, for instance, just stopped recycling glass. But plastics are tough because there's so many different types of plastics. I mean, I started trying to count how many plastics I touched on a daily basis, and, you know, you lose count after a couple minutes. And they're all just different types of plastic. So, you know, you can't just put it all into a bin and melt it down and make it into new plastic. There are all these different types, and some types are easy to recycle. If you think about laundry bottles or kind of stiff plastic, that's a little easier to recycle than really flimsy plastic like dry cleaner bags or the tops of coffee cups. And the other problem with plastics is that there are a lot of really little ones. And so if you think of, you know, you throw something in the recycling and then the truck comes and picks it up, think about a straw or a soy sauce packet or a ketchup packet. Those things are probably going to fall out, and then they get in the drains, they blow away, and then they get in the water, and then they get in the ocean, which you know, we have this big Pacific garbage patch that's bigger than Texas. So that's another problem, too.
We're speaking with Alana Semuels, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's written a piece entitled, Is This the End of Recycling? The solutions here, what, with our water bottles, go back to glass, but then they become more expensive, right? I don't know. What are solutions?
Yeah, I mean, the easy solution is just to consume less stuff, but that's going to be a pretty hard sell. You know, the American economy is kind of based on consumption. You see a few companies that are trying to get people to buy reusable things. So, for instance, there's a company that's trying to get you to sign up for its service, and they send you brand name items in reusable tins, so you could get your, you know, Haagen-Dazs ice cream in a reusable metal tin, and then you send it back at the end of the day. But that's obviously pretty expensive, and there's greenhouse gases emitted from bringing it back and forth. I mean, I think the best solution is to get companies to think about packaging and how they make things and what they're making things out of. But right now, it's just so cheap to make things out of plastic. Petroleum is cheap, and it's just, you know, there's no motivation for them to think about it, especially, you know, public companies that have shareholders they have to report to. If they're just going to say, hey, we're going to make things a little more expensive so we can be good for the environment, there's really no incentive for that so far. So my opinion is maybe some sort of government action, but, you know, the government isn't exactly passing a lot of stuff right now, so it might take a while.
Thanks, Alana. Alana Semuels at The Atlantic. 21 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Weekend, hey, glad you're with us. Looking to build an investment portfolio or rethink the mix you already own? Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements has put together some simple steps to help you build a sensible, low-cost portfolio of index funds. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what do we do?
The first step is really the most fundamental, and yet one many investors never ask themselves, which is, why are you investing? What's your goal? What are you trying to achieve? Because that goes to the crucial issue of time horizon. I mean, if you've got money that you're going to need to pay your teenager's college tuition bills or to make a house down payment next year, the investment strategy that you pursue is going to be totally different than if you're trying to pay for a retirement that won't start for 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
And so the first question everybody needs to ask is, why are you investing?
And then step number two, pick your provider.
So most of us want to keep our financial lives relatively simple, and so we're going to want to settle on just one or two major investment firms to deal with. And one of the first questions you're going to want to think about is, do I want to buy index mutual funds, in which case you're going to end up either Fidelity, Schwab, or Vanguard, or am I going to buy exchange-traded index funds? At that point, you know, if you're a do-it-yourself investor, there are a whole bunch of different discount brokerage firms you can go to. Like Schwab, Fidelity, and Vanguard all have discount brokerage arms. There are also firms like TD Ameritrade, E-Trade, and so on. And so suddenly your choice of financial providers becomes much larger. But as you think about those financial providers, don't only think about, you know, what it's going to cost you to trade and what the expenses are on the mutual funds or the ETFs that you plan to buy, but also think about what you're going to get charged on the cash account. Be because for a lot of financial firms, the cash account that they offer is where they make a big chunk of their money. And you can see this if you go and compare, you know, the cash account at many discount brokerage firms with what you can get if, say, you go to Vanguard and you buy their low-cost money market fund. With their low-cost money market fund, you might be getting 2.5% at Vanguard. If you go to a lot of brokerage firms, you know, you're not getting one-fifth of that on the cash account.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, editor and founder of HumbleDollar.com. He's put together some steps if you want to put together your own investment portfolio or want to rethink the mix you already have. Skipping around, step number five, build your own. Explain that.
So the most competitive area of the index fund market now, both ETFs and index mutual funds, are so-called total market funds. And if you really want to hold down your investment costs and also manage your annual investment tax bill, what you may want to do is put together a collection of three total market funds, a total U.S. stock market fund, a total U.S. bond market fund, and a total international stock fund. These are fiercely competitive arenas when it comes to gathering assets by the fund companies and the ETF providers. So some of these funds are actually available at no expenses now. Fidelity rolled out its zero funds last year. So you can get into this part of the market and put together a portfolio, and your total annual costs might be 5 or 6 cents a year for every $100 you have invested. And the big advantage beyond low cost is when you put together that portfolio, you can take the bond portion and you can put it in your retirement account. What's the advantage of that? Well, by having those taxable bonds in your retirement account, you can avoid paying taxes each year on the interest that you earn. Mm. And as a consequence, you'll have a much more tax-efficient portfolio and a smaller bill owed to the IRS when April 15th rolls around.
It's Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
I used to have a sweet tooth, had it removed when I was a kid. So what do I crave instead of chocolate? A big red box from Grainger. Grainger satisfies my craving for great customer service with 24/7 support, effortless ordering, and same-day pickup or next-day delivery options. No busy signals, no cavities. I love Grainger. You know why? Because when it comes to reliable product and technical support, Grainger's got your back. Call or click Grainger.com to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome aboard. How'd you like to have all the necessary tools to repair things yourself, or at least get stuff repaired for free? If so, you might be supportive of the so-called right to repair legislation, which is being considered by New York State lawmakers and advocates who hope to see it passed this year. The movement is centered in volunteer groups offering free repairs to anyone bringing a busted gadget to a meeting. Wall Street Journal columnist Ann Cadet watched a group called the Fixers Collective, a long-running volunteer outfit that meets twice a month in Brooklyn and Manhattan. Ann, what's up here?
It's kind of a growing movement where people who like to fix things are sharing their skills with people who can't fix things. But kind of the bigger picture is that these people are starting to rebel against the idea that a lot of manufacturers of electronics and digital technologies are making it harder and harder to fix your own stuff. So not only are they trying to take the power back into their own hands by sharing a lot of tools and information with each other and helping people in their communities fix their things, they're also trying to pass some new laws that would require manufacturers to share information, make parts available at an affordable price, so that people can fix their own stuff or take it to an independent repair dealership rather than having to go to the company or go to an authorized dealer or throw the thing away when it breaks.
Wow. So are they doing it for free, these repair clubs?
Yeah. The one that I actually visited has been around for almost a decade. They're centered in New York City. They're called the Fixers Collective, and they get together twice a month in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, and they'll meet up in a little room, and anyone who wants to can come by, and people bring their iPhones and their old lamps and their humidifiers and their vacuum cleaners and their toaster ovens, anything that needs fixing, and these people will fix it for you for free. And then it's really growing upstate in the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. There's a kind of a federation of places called repair cafes. They were started by a
fellow in Kingston about 5 years ago, and it's since spread to about 25 different towns all over the Hudson Valley. And they set up little events in town halls and libraries and community centers where they kind of replicate the same idea. These folks who are, you know, engineers and tech types will fix anything that anyone wants to bring in.
I assume device makers are not happy with this.
No, they don't like it at all. They want to control the process. And the defense they use is that they believe that if consumers are allowed to fix their own devices, that we will injure ourselves. And they also have some difficulties with like intellectual property rights. Like if they have to share the information about their devices, then I'm not super clear on why that would be a problem. But basically they feel like they should be able to control all the information about how their devices should be repaired.
We're speaking
can be repaired, yeah.
Thanks, Ann. Wall Street Journal columnist Ann Cadet. By the way, don't forget we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter with the username at This Morning Show. You could follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username at Gordon Deal. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Celebrating St. Patrick's Day this weekend, how does your event match up to these? Seeker.com is a list of 7 ways of celebrating St. Patty's Day around the world that are fun, wacky, and just plain odd. 1. Hot Springs, Arkansas, home to the shortest St. Patrick's Day parade, all 98 feet of Bridge Street. 2. Number 2, members of the Shamrock Club in New London, Wisconsin, dress up as leprechauns and change highway signs so the town name reads New Dublin. Number 3, for more than 40 years, the Chicago River has been dyed green on St. Patrick's Day. It's an eco-friendly vegetable dye. Number 4, in the Irish capital of Nebraska, O'Neill, residents wear green on the 17th, not just of March, but of every month. Number 5, on the Caribbean island of Montserrat, St. Patrick's Day is a national holiday celebrating both rich Irish and African heritage. Number 6, Brisbane, Australia hosts a big bash portraying widows and orphans, miners, teachers, and everyone in between. And number 7, Bonwyn, Wales insists that St. Patrick was Welsh, so it stages a parade that leads to where the patron saint of Ireland was allegedly born. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.